We're going to get started. The Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee today is January 22nd, 2013. Members, we don't yet have a quorum. Just so members know, the governor is meeting with the House and Senate Democrats. That's why I apologize. I was late. We're going to get started, and then when we have a quorum, we will officially call the meeting to order, and then we'll adopt the minutes. So with that, the first presenter is David Paul. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Executive Secretary to the Judicial Standards Board. So please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I am David Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board on Judicial Standards. I'm just going to spend a few moments telling you a little bit about what we do, and if you have any questions, I would be more than happy to answer them. And I could touch just slightly, I know this isn't the time for this, but I could touch slightly on what we are, what the governor's budget has this morning recommended, but I'm not going to center on that. The Board on Judicial Standards is the state's only agency that receives and processes complaints alleging that a Minnesota judge or a Minnesota hearings officer is engaged in judicial misconduct or wrongdoing. And the board also handles judicial disability matters, mental and allegations of mental and physical disability on the part of judges. Our authority includes district court judges, all the appellate court judges, referees, child support magistrates, active retired judges, Minnesota tax court judges, workers' compensation court of appeals judges, any judge who is paid by the judiciary is under the board's jurisdiction. Groups like the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals and the tax court judges are under our jurisdiction strictly by agreement, since they are executive-style judges. The court, the administrative law judge, has kind of an interesting relationship with our board. Pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 14.48, the chief administrative law judge is to apply the code of judicial conduct to the extent applicable. I'm just quoting from the statute. And and so the judge really has a responsibility to supervise the judges who report to him, and then quoting again from the statute, in a manner consistent with interpretations made by the Board on Judicial Standards. We don't really know whether the chief judge is under our jurisdiction or not, but there's a great deal of cooperation between the two agencies, and it really doesn't matter. They share with us, we share with them on administrative hearings matters, and the goal is just to get to the right result. The board's mission, it can be described in very complicated ways, but probably the simplest way to describe it is the agency seeks to protect the public by assuring that the judicial process is fair, impartial, independent, promoting citizens' recognition and respect for the judiciary. The Board on Judicial Standards exists to provide citizens a process that promotes the public trust and maintain their confidence in our legal system. In addition to processing these allegations of misconduct or disability, the agency engages in number of other types of activities. For example, we review the compliance of judges to make timely decisions under Minnesota Statute 546.27. This is the statute that requires that most decisions on anything, any final decision or any motion, be filed within 90 days of the date of submission. And there are, in fact, literally hundreds of different deadlines, but the board in any event uses these deadlines as guidelines and conducts reviews when these guidelines are violated. the board, I, as the only operative member of the board, I research and respond to inquiries from judges, in addition to inquiries from the general public and the legislature relating to the Code of Judicial Conduct, the agency, judicial procedures. I educate and inform judges about judicial ethics through seminars, briefings, literature, new judge orientation, these types of conferences. I report to the Supreme Court on retired judges, or whenever they ask for the record of a judge, we always respond. I, of course, write the annual report, which is required by the legislature. I prepare and process all the administrative and accounting functions required by state operations, including budget, accounting, payroll, human resources, etc. I must say that recently my one assistant of 37 years retired, so that side of the board needs a little bit of stabilization, but we're getting there very quickly and should be done with it fairly soon. The legislature authorizes the Supreme Court to make rules which operate the board and govern it and are binding on it. And this the Supreme Court has done. The code was last looked at in 2009, and the operating rules were last looked at in 2009. Both the revised codes and operating rules are effective July 1st, 2009. I think if there's one thing which would be the most important thing for me to say to you today and to get across to you, it is the importance and the definition of the limitation on our authority. The board has authority only over personal conduct of the judge. Under Rule 4C, the board may not consider the actions of a judge in finding facts, for example, in applying the law, as long as it's good faith effort by the judge to do so in a way that it is understood by him or her. And, of course, applying the law and finding the facts is the traditional job of the court system, and the review of those duties are the traditional functions of the appellate system, and that's the way it should be. One entity finding facts and applying the law. But, of course, what we do is completely different. The way I like to define it to people is that any time the judge is acting in his or her decisional capacity, making a decision, a ruling, an objection on evidence, then this is the type of thing, if somebody contends that the judge has done this incorrectly, this is the type of thing that should stay in the courts and be resolved by the court system. What we have jurisdiction over is just about everything else. All the rest of the conduct is personal. For example, if a judge was arrested for drunken driving or something like that, this is the kind of personal conduct over which the board has sole authority.
Mr. Paul, I apologize, but if I could stop you for a moment. We do have a quorum here, so I'm going to entertain a motion by a member to approve the minutes of January 16th. A motion's been moved. Mm-hmm. All in favor of approving minutes as stated of January 16th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Paul. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I think the other important thing to remember with regard to the limitations on the board authority is that just because the board doesn't have authority over something that a judge did doesn't mean that the judge did it correctly. Certainly doesn't mean that the judge didn't do it correctly. I mean, judges don't do the right thing all the time. Who of us do? But rather, the limitation is a recognition that such allegations must be made to those who have the power to consider them, review them, change them if necessary. And this is the court system. And so anybody who deals with us has to kind of go on a dual track. The court system for the legal aspects of their case, and us for the personal aspects of their case. The basic procedure is not complicated. We can issue a complaint from any source, even a newspaper if we want. Some of our complaints are issued on from anonymous sources. I, as the executive secretary, review them. I check them to see that there is an allegation over which the board does have authority, and if there is one, the board votes on whether or not to pursue that allegation. And if it finds that there's reasonable cause to determine that misconduct has occurred, it proposes discipline to the judge, and the judge can either agree with the discipline or have a hearing. And if there's a hearing, the Supreme Court appoints a panel. We have a hearing within 90 days. We have a decision usually within another 90 days of the submission of the case. And then either party, the judge or the board, may appeal to the Supreme Court or whatever the panel's decision is. Possible discipline items are under our Rule 11, and they run a very large gamut: public reprimand, public censure, civil penalty, suspension with pay, suspension without pay, retirement, removal, or a combination of these things. Again, the board has the authority only to propose these items of discipline and may not impose them by itself. Either the judge agrees or insists on a hearing. Let me just speak very briefly about our revolving appropriation. Historically, a consistent priority issue for the agency has been the funding for costs in investigations and in public hearings. As I just stated, if the board finds that there's reasonable cause in a matter involving a judicial officer for unethical conduct or for disability, it proposes a corrective measure or a series of corrective measures, and if not accepted, we have the prospect of a hearing. Like any legal proceeding, it's very similar to any legal proceeding. There are lawyer's fees, there are investigation costs, there are the costs of staging the hearing, such as reporter fees. All these elements are paid for and arranged for by the board. The board is not in direct control, obviously, of what it might seek in any given budget year. And predicting these costs has always been elusive and just impossible. And they cannot be postponed because they're in the nature of legal proceedings, and they cannot be delayed, and they don't always fit into the best legislative timetable because of they can come from any period of the year, and the agency does incur these deficit expenses. And there has been numerous deficiency requests over the years. Since 2002, we've had six, and in 2008, we had the legislature awarded us, after much discussion, a revolving fund of $125,000 per year, which we can use to defray these costs, and which has been unbelievably helpful. Because once we have the initial $125,000, we can go out and seek court reporters. We can seek other supporting services and negotiate them for ourselves. Before, because we didn't have the money, we had to rely on our attorneys to do that. And, of course, that was one step removed from us. And, they had to take the time to do it. This is a much more economical way to do it. And we found that. And every year we do need a deficiency, so we find that it's very, very helpful to have this initial money. Let me just take any questions that you might have, but before I do so, I just want to mention that there is one outstanding public hearing pending now against the judge. It will be, there's nothing secretive about it. It's been disclosed to the public. Our complaint is on our website, as is the judge's answer. And this case comes up in just a month. And also, we have two disability proceedings we are following quite closely. So this is the basis for our deficiency at this point in time. In 2012, our board, that is me, I'm the only person in the board other than my assistant, who, as I said, is retired. I fielded 1,200 phone calls last year from the general public. I processed over 150 inquiries from judges and judicial officers. We wrote several written advisory opinions. We processed over 100 written complaints, and we got almost 18,000 hits on our website, which we are trying very hard to improve. I think that's all I wanted to say to you, and I would be more than happy if you had any questions to try to address them.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Paul, you stated in your list of available remedies, I think you said civil penalties twice. Was there something else that was supposed to go in there other than civil penalties? Do you have jurisdiction to implement criminal penalties?
Madam Mr. Chair. Paul.
No, we don't. We have no jurisdiction at all in any criminal area. If I said civil penalties twice, I apologize for it. We do have the authority to fine judges and civil penalties. I never was quite clear on what the distinction would be, but that is the limit of our authority on just general fines.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Follow up, to what body would a judge appeal if he or she didn't like your decision?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson, the judge either accepts our decision or he or she seeks a hearing from a panel appointed by the Supreme Court. And then once that panel makes its decision, either the board or the judge or the hearings officer or the judicial hearings officer can appeal that panel decision to the Supreme Court, and they will make the final decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Paul, can you tell me, so if you do find someone, are who you find and how much, is that all public information? Mr. Paul?
Madam Chairperson, it is public information. I don't have everybody that we find. There are several people I could probably think of that we find, but I if you don't mind, I would prefer not to mention them. I hate to single them out.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Paul, I'm not asking you to do that here today. The question was, if someone wanted to inquire, is that public information, and then is that something listed on your website, or would they inquire to your office, or how would that work, Mr. Paul?
Madam Chairperson, all you have to do is give us a call. We can pull that together. I'm sorry I misunderstood your question.
Other questions from members? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we're going to have a presentation from the tax court. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Chairman Hillstrom, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Brad Della Pena. I am Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. With me today is Judge Joanne Turner. Judge Turner and I both joined the tax court in December 2012. By statute, the court has three judges. We also have three staff, including an administrator and a paralegal. Tax policy and rates are set by politically accountable representatives at the state and local level. Tax policy and rates are applied and enforced by state and local officials, including the Commissioner of Revenue. When taxpayers believe the tax laws have been improperly applied, they can file a case in the tax court to challenge government action. The tax court is a neutral tribunal which dispassionately determines what the law requires and ensures that it is properly applied in individual cases. The court is thus an essential part of the state's overall system of taxation. It ensures taxpayers' fairness, accuracy, and consistency. At a high level of generalization, there are two kinds of tax court cases. The first and largest category is property tax cases. Local and county officials annually determine the market value of real property and send property owners tax statements. Taxpayers frequently disagree with these market value determinations or with the manner in which their property was classified for tax purposes. Tax court cases involve properties ranging from personal residences to large tracts of timber to vast industrial complexes. Petitions can also challenge entire taxing schemes or valuation methodologies. 98% of the tax court cases are property tax appeals. The second category of tax court cases involve orders issued by the Minnesota Commissioner of Revenue. The commissioner enforces numerous state taxes, including those pertaining to income, sales and use, cigarettes, gasoline, and insurance. Taxpayers disagreeing with assessment orders issued by the Commissioner of Revenue bring a wide variety of challenges to the Minnesota Tax Court. For example, a retailer might dispute whether the delivery charges associated with a purchase are subject to a sales tax. A multinational corporation might challenge in court whether its operations qualify as a unitary business. Or an apartment dweller might claim that his renter's rebate was improperly calculated. Although the commissioner cases constitute only about 2% of the court's docket, they tend to have broad precedential effect. Having described the court's docket in categorical terms, let me give you some figures, and I'll be using fiscal year 2000 just as a basis for comparison. In 2000, taxpayers filed 1,300 cases in the tax court. Filing swelled to 4,840 cases in 2009 and peaked at 5,870 cases in 2010. That's a 350% increase since base year 2000. There were about 4,800 cases filed in 2012, and that's about a 270% increase as compared to fiscal year 2000. Thus, whereas there were approximately 430 new cases per judge filed in 2000, there have recently been between 1,600 and 1,950 new cases per judge filed. The massive increase in the court's caseload presents obvious challenges for the court's judges and its modest staff. Judge Turner will detail those challenges and the court's response in a moment. One consequence of the court's increased caseload is that the court's collection of filing fees can now more than support the court's budget. In fiscal year 2000, the court generated $150,000 in filing fees and had a budget of $717,000, a shortfall of $560,000. Specifically, because the court plays a critical role in ensuring the fairness of the state's overall system of taxation, the legislature was willing to subsidize the court's operations. Both filing fees and filings have increased since 2000. In fiscal year 2012, the court generated approximately $1.5 million in filing fees and had a budget of $825,000.
Excuse me if I might interrupt. So how much is a filing fee, and is it all the same, or does it depend on which type of tax lawsuit that you filed?
Chairman Hillstrom, the fee is for the tax court filing is the district court filing fee by statute. The current fee level is $310, and so it's simply, you know, I've determined the figure simply by multiplying the number of filings per year by the relevant filing fee. To go back to 2000, the filing fee for district courts and for the tax court was $122. So both, you know, you've had about a quadrupling of the number of cases, and you've had a substantial increase in the filing fee per case.
Thank you. Continue.
So the final point I wanted to make was that the court currently collects in filing fees, and these fees all go to the general fund, by the way, approximately twice its annual budget. Let me turn it over now to Judge Turner, again, to detail some of the challenges the court's facing and the court's response to those challenges.
Judge Turner, please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Joanne Turner, and I'm a judge in the Minnesota Tax Court. Chairman Hillstrom, thank you. As Chief Judge Della Pena indicated, the court's caseload has significantly increased in recent years. There are no jury trials in tax court, which means that tax court judges are responsible for preparing written findings of fact, conclusions of law, and memoranda in each of the cases heard. By law, those findings, conclusions of law, and memoranda must be filed within 90 days of the case being submitted. As Chief Judge Della Pena has indicated as well, these cases also involve complex substantive and procedural issues. They are fact-intensive, dealing with the nature of the property, the number of square feet, that sort of thing. They typically, almost in property taxes, almost always involve expert testimony. In fact, it's not uncommon for the only witnesses in a case to testify to be the experts, testifying as to competing appraisals of the property's value. To give you an indication, again, of the effect that the tax court's increase in caseload has had on the workings of the court, in 2000, the year we're using as a baseline, the three judges in the tax court issued a total of 82 orders and decisions. In 2012, the most recent calendar year, the tax court issued 426 orders and decisions. And for the last quarter of that year, the tax court was down two judges. There was only one judge sitting on the tax court for the fourth quarter of last year. If that's the workload that faces us, the three of us on the court now, what are the challenges facing us as an institution?
If I could interrupt, why was there only one judge sitting on the bench? Was that a caused there by the legislature or vacancies? Judge Turner.
Chairman Hillstrom, there were two resignations. Judge Sandberg resigned to take a position with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court, and that was in August of last year. And then Judge Cheryl Ramstead resigned in September.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Chairman. First, the court's heavy caseload is projected to continue for the foreseeable future. Just to give you an idea of what that caseload is, at the end of 2012, there were over 7,700 cases on file at the tax court. That's roughly 25 or 2,600 cases pending per judge. We expect to receive 4,800 new filings in 2013. And as you know, property tax appeals must all be filed by April 30th of the year in which taxes are paid. So we will get 4,800 new cases filed in the first 4 months of 2013. So by May 1st, each of us will have on our respective plates almost 4,200 cases to be resolved one way or the other. We expect this caseload to continue for the foreseeable future. Property tax appeals, again, are affected by changes both upward and downward in property values. And because the jurisdictions in the state are on 3 or 5 year assessment cycles, it really won't be until property values stabilize statewide and remain stable for a period of time that we expect our caseload to level off. So even if property values stabilize statewide, we can expect to see high volumes of appeals for at least a few years after that. Property tax appeals, again, 98% of our caseload are filed in the county in which the property is located and then transferred to our court by order. We use a very old case management system, which is not compatible with the district court's case management systems. The case management system in which the cases are initially filed. That means they are transferred to us and we are notified of the transfer on paper. We must then hand enter all of that information into our own docket system. in order to be able to begin processing those cases and issue orders. In recent years, it has taken our small staff basically the entire calendar year to do that. It is as though we swallow an elephant in April of each year and take the next 8 months to digest it. We have just finished entering 2012 case filings into our case management system.
Excuse me, Representative Fortman.
Thank you. Have you gotten a bid on what it would cost to replace the computer system and make it compatible with the district court system?
Judge Turner.
Chairman Hillstrom, Representative, in fact, in the last week, with the help of our partners in the judicial branch, and particularly State Court Administrator Jeff Shorba, we think we've been able to determine that we can become a node on the district court's case management system at no cost to the taxpayer, beyond perhaps some initial training and some configuration costs that we hope to be able to get in this budget year. Doing that would pretty much revolutionize what we do.
Thank you.
I appreciate the question. Thank you. Our second challenge, is managing and processing this statewide docket in which cases are initially filed someplace else and transferred to us by order. As I've just indicated, we're in the process of trying to figure out how to address that. Our third challenge is timely management of that docket, given that it is virtually entirely filed in the first 4 months of the year. Historically, the court's processing of these cases has been quite inefficient. Once a case is filed, the court issues what's called a first trial setting, typically 6 to 9 months out. The parties are were free to ignore that first trial setting, provided that they notified the court by noon the day before that they simply had decided not to come and requested a new trial setting. The court would then issue a second trial setting order, which the parties were also free to ignore, provided that they notified the court by noon the day before. By that point, the case is already 12 to 16 months old. The parties would then engage in a round of pretrial conference calls, typically 3 to 6 months apart, at which the parties would notify the court of the status or lack thereof in the case. After the second of those calls, they would be given a trial date certain. At that point, the case was already probably about 2 years old. Put another way, each of these cases historically has required no fewer than 4 contacts with the court, and typically many more than that, in 18 to 24 months, and at the end of that process was typically no closer to being resolved than when it was first filed. Our fourth challenge, we have large numbers of pro se and indigent litigants.
If I might interrupt, so Judge Turner, have you done something then to reform that? Because you were saying that was historically what was happening. So is that still the current process for how long it takes one of these cases to get through the process? Judge Turner.
Chairman Hillstrom, we are in the process of changing that system and changing it radically. In the 6 weeks that Chief Judge Della Pena and I have been there, we have begun moving the court to more of a block system and what's used in the district courts. So our new process going forward and our process with existing cases as they begin to come before us is that we will issue first a first scheduling order, which will require the parties to do something they have historically never been required to do in tax court, and that's talk to each other about the case. We will require them to exchange positions. The taxpayer will have to tell the county, for example, in a property tax case, what the taxpayer's position is on the issues that were raised in the petition. If it's a valuation challenge, the taxpayer will be required to tell the county, here's what I think my property is worth. If it's a challenge to the classification of the property, the taxpayer will be required to tell the county, here's what I think my property ought to be classified as. That's something that's never been done in tax court before. The county will be required to respond to that. If that doesn't produce a settlement, then the parties will file a joint statement of the case, which will tell me as a trial court judge, here are the issues we think are going to have to be tried. here's the additional discovery we'd like to take, and here's how long that process will take. If the parties anticipate requiring expert testimony, here's how long our experts will take to get ready, and here's how long we think the case will take to try. And based on that information, then we'll be in a position to issue an intelligent scheduling order that will get the case ready for trial. Once we know which cases are ready for trial, then we will issue an order setting the case for trial. We are no longer going to issue routine trial settings that the parties are free to ignore, and which, quite frankly, historically, we have never tracked. We don't even keep track of those orders. Does that help?
Thank you.
Chairman, thank you.
Please go ahead.
Our fourth challenge, again, is large numbers of pro se and indigent litigants. By statute, we must pay out-of-pocket costs. The court must pay out-of-pocket costs. The state must pay out-of-pocket costs for transcripts, filing fees, copies of exhibits, and so on for indigent litigants. And those are typically individuals who are appealing orders from the Commissioner of Revenue. We have never had a specific budget allocation for payment of these costs. And historically, in some instances, they have been the costs that necessitated the court to shut down and for its employees to take unpaid leave in order to fund those costs. At the same time, the tax court, like all courts in the state, is seeing increasing numbers of litigants without legal representation. And those pro se litigants, just as in the district courts, require extra time to explain court procedures. They just generally take more time and more hands-on attention. And our fifth challenge has been a historic lack of resources, the kinds of resources available to the district courts in assisting in preparing for trial. Although we are a trial court, we have never had, for example, law clerks, recent law school graduates to assist us in preparing for trial. The court has never had that resource. Historically, the court has never had access to electronic legal research. We've never had Westlaw. We've never had Lexis. Things that are common in the district courts.
So if I could ask,
yes.
Then how do you do your legal research if you never have access to that, Judge Turner?
That's a really good question, to which the answer is not entirely clear. Historically, for example, the court has required the parties to provide to it copies of the court cases cited in their briefs. And that's how the court has been able to do that. As you may imagine, finding only the portions of the law that the parties are willing to disclose to you is not always a satisfying result.
Please continue, Judge Turner.
Thank you, Chairman Hillstrom. As Chief Judge Della Pena has indicated, we've begun, and as my testimony so far has indicated, we've begun responding to several of these challenges. First, we've made significant changes to the way that we process cases for trial. We've eliminated this idea of first and second trial settings, and instead, we've moved to a system that requires the parties to provide us with information about the case, and then we'll issue a scheduling order, with the idea of getting these cases to trial in something closer to 12 or 18 months. And the idea in doing so is quite simple. Number one, we're trying to reduce the amount of attorney's fees the parties have to pay. Number two, we're trying to reduce the amount of interest the parties have to pay on additional payments or refunds. And just to give you an example, in 2009, according to published reports, Hennepin County paid out something in excess of $15 million in property tax refunds. That's to be expected in a year in which property values are generally falling. But Hennepin County also paid out that year over $1 million in interest on those refunds at post-judgment rates. Why? Because the cases simply were taking so long to get to trial. Second, we've implemented procedures to try cases more efficiently once they do get to trial. We are now, for the first time, requiring the parties to stipulate before trial to the objectively verifiable characteristics of the property, square footage, for example. And that just speeds up trial because it's fewer things that I, as a judge, have to decide. We've required the parties to stipulate to the admissibility of exhibits before trial and to exchange expert reports well in advance of trial. These aren't new ideas. They're ideas in practice in the district courts across the state. In fact, many of them were pioneered by my mentor in private practice, former Chief Judge of Hennepin County, Jim Swenson. And they've been in use in family court, in the U.S. tax court, at the PUC. And these are techniques that are proven to work. We're going to also require that pretrial pleadings be filed with the court well in advance of trial. That gives me, as a trial judge, the opportunity to read things before trial starts, to be familiar with the case, and to reduce the amount of time the parties have to spend educating me about the file. And again, at each of these stages, we've increased the likelihood that the case will settle because we've required the parties to put their cards on the table, as they do in any civil case. The more I understand about my case and the more I understand about the risks of trying it, the more I understand about your case and the risks you face in trying it, the more likely we are to be able to get it settled. Far more likely than if I go into court not knowing what my expert is going to say and you go into trial not knowing what your expert is going to say. Third, as I indicated, with the help of our partners in the judicial branch, and particularly Jeff Shorba, we've begun to investigate the possibility of adopting the same case management system that's in use by the district courts. And fourth, we've used a small portion of our salary savings, again, not having to pay two judges for the last quarter of the year, to contract for Westlaw on an interim basis, and that will further improve our efficiency and also the accuracy of our decisions by being able to double-check that the cases we've cited are still good and by allowing us to quickly find the law that's pertinent to the issues facing the court. There's much about the internal operation of the tax court that Judge Delapena and I are still learning, but looking a little bit farther down the road, as the district courts move to electronic filing, we anticipate we will also be able to do so once all of the state courts are on board. That's going to have to wait until all of the district courts are part of the e-filing project, and it will require a little investment in technology for our court as well, which is way behind in technology. And we also anticipate eventually we may be able to hear cases by interactive video. Again, these cases are filed in all 87 counties in the state. The taxpayer has the right to have the case heard in the county of their residence, in the county in which the property is located. And so we travel all over the state to hear cases. We're hoping that someday we may be able to eliminate some of those travel costs by hearing cases by ITV. Again, at no inconvenience to the taxpayer whose property is at issue, but lower cost to a court as a whole. And with that, that concludes our formal presentation. We'd be happy to respond to other questions from the committee.
Questions from members? Representative Portman.
Well, just to follow up, I sort of missed at the beginning that you've both just been there for 6 weeks. So it sounds like it's been a busy 6 weeks.
It's a very steep learning curve.
It sounds, Chair Hellstrom, it sounds like there's an enormous overhaul that's needed in the tax court, and it sounds like the two of you are taking that on. It sounds like you need another judge. It sounds like you need more staff, and you definitely need Westlaw. I just wondered if you'd respond to those questions.
Chairman Hillstrom, Representative Portman, we've asked in the governor to furnish us with some of the resources that you've identified. So I'll just remind you, I think there's about a fourfold increase in caseload since 2000. Roughly fivefold increase. One way of addressing that resource problem, well, first of all, the problem generated by that increase was the court slowly falling behind and the number of cases in stock going up, so you have a backlog. You also just have the problem of treading water, of coming level with the 4,500 cases that we expect the caseload to level to. So one way we could address that is with additional judges. What we asked for was for law clerks, which is the traditional tool that courts use to process cases. Researching, doing legal research, first drafts of simple parts of decisions like findings of fact. The judge always ultimately controls that, but the law clerk is really the tool of choice for courts. If we come to a caseload of 4,500, 1,500 cases a year per judge, we'd be about level pegging with the district courts, which have between one and two law clerks. If we could bring our resources to that level, I think Judge Turner and myself, together with the third tax court judge and the staff, would have a go at fixing the backlog. I think it would take about 3 years, but I think we can come to a level again where we're processing the same number of cases as we're receiving and have cleared out the backlog. Our submission, at least, was that those resources were probably more desirable than adding judges at this time. Let's have a go at a more modest solution.
And if I might add, the number of judges we have is set by statute. And so we're thinking that the number of law clerks we've got is a more flexible solution. Obviously, if we add judge lines, it's going to be hard to get rid of them in the future if our caseload would drop back down. But we think we'd like to have a go at handling what we've got with some additional resources without adding judge lines, if that's possible to do.
Representative Hortman, do you have a follow-up?
Well, I just think the committee should look at it because 3 years is a long time to get caught up, and we meet every year, and we change statutes every year. So if we give you an additional judge, we could also sunset it. But it seems like for the taxpayers out there who are waiting for a determination, we want to get things done. And since you're a net positive for the general fund, you're contributing $700,000, your fees are more than paying for your budget, it seems that we should give you the resources you need to do the work. But that's all I have.
May I briefly comment on that?
Go ahead.
The tax court statute is Chapter 271, and the provision actually allows the appointment of a referee to handle small claims matters. And one possible approach to addressing some of the backlog, which would be less expensive and inherently temporary, would be that sort of solution.
Thank you. I just have one, I guess, question or comment, and I'm sure you've thought of this, but on the Westlaw issue, I guess just because I can't imagine life without Westlaw, and you know you're unique because you're in the executive branch, but have you looked to see if state agencies, like I would think the Department of Revenue would have to have a subscription to Westlaw. I mean, they have plenty of attorneys doing legal research. Have you looked to see if there are any state agencies that you can sort of piggyback off of and use their Westlaw resources?
We are independent of the commissioner's staff, commissioner of revenue, for fairly obvious reasons. We did not investigate that, although we our interim Westlaw contract is on the same terms as any other state contract would be. So we are paying for it based on the number of judges we've added, number of judicial passwords we've got, and I don't know of any reason to believe that the pricing would be any different if we were to essentially add passwords to a commissioner contract. We're getting the same deal, as it were, that's available to the other agencies. Okay. If that helps, Representative Mellon.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Lean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question pertaining to how cases are heard. As far as you had said, the 2% of the court's caseload is largely review of orders issued by the Commissioner of Revenue. Is that individuals appealing those rulings by the Commissioner of Revenue, or just a little bit how those cases are brought to the tax court?
Representative Lean, the one way to think about the commissioner cases is as a declaratory judgment action. So the commissioner is the first line of enforcement, will issue an order of assessment if they think you've underpaid your income tax. What you really become in the tax court is a plaintiff, and you're suing for a declaration that the Commissioner of Revenue got it wrong. So you would file a tax court action, and then standard civil discovery would apply. You could depose the auditor who did your case, you could request documents, and the commissioner could do the same thing. And this is what Judge Turner was saying. We're now, rather than setting first trials, arbitrarily. We would create a scheduling order. The case would proceed in that orderly fashion. And if it came to trial, we as the court would sit with you as a taxpayer in equal footing with the Commissioner of Revenue, both parties before the court. We would decide as judges what the law requires, whether it was correctly applied in your case. And we would issue a decision. And finally, you could appeal that decision to the Minnesota Supreme Court if you were dissatisfied with our resolution.
And just to follow up again, we are a trial court, although they are called appeals from the Commissioner of Revenue or appeals from a property tax determination. We are a trial court. We have people swearing and exhibits and witnesses and the whole nine yards, from which then an appeal is taken to directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court, bypassing the Court of Appeals.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next presentation is by Civil Legal Services. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Lund. I am the Executive Director of the Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota, which is headquartered in Duluth and serves the Arrowhead region of the state. I'm accompanied today by my friend and colleague, Kathy Hockadall, who is the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, which is headquartered in Minneapolis and serves the central region of the state. I am very grateful to all of you to have this opportunity to talk for just a few minutes about the role of civil legal services in providing administering justice in the state of Minnesota. It's an issue that I obviously feel very passionately about, and it's a value that I suspect all of you share. I don't think it is an accident that our Pledge of Allegiance ends with, "and justice for all." Justice is a core value that we as Americans, and I think particularly as Minnesotans, all share. And I think that the best way I can illustrate the way that that sort of high-level value comes down to the lives of individual citizens in Minnesota is to share with you a case that we recently handled in my program. It occurred actually just before the holidays. We were approached by a woman who I will call Martha, not her real name, obviously. Martha had received an eviction notice from her landlord because she was several months behind in paying her rent. In meeting with her, our attorney learned that back in 2009, Martha's husband had been in a traffic accident and suffered a traumatic brain injury that left him in need of permanent nursing home care. So in one fell swoop, the family had lost the husband's income and acquired a mountain of medical debt. In the 3 years since, Martha had been working every hour she could get in addition to taking care of her two young children and had been prioritizing the payment of the back medical debts. But had not been able to keep up with her other bills. And so things came to a head in 2012 when she literally reached the point where she was choosing between paying for her rent and utilities for herself and her children or paying for the back medical debts. Martha sincerely believed, incorrectly, but sincerely, that if she didn't pay those medical debts, her husband would lose his nursing home care, which for him would have amounted to a death sentence. So she felt like she was in the position of choosing between a home for herself and her kids and her husband's life. And so she was prioritizing his life. Armed with that information, our attorney was able to contact the landlord, explain the situation to him, negotiate some time to work out a plan to bring Martha up to date. She was able to contact another local nonprofit, get funds to pay off all of Martha's outstanding rent and catch up, and then also work out the medical bills so they could be restructured in a way that Martha could afford. So at the end of the day, and just in time for the holidays, Martha and her children had a place to live, the landlord was made whole, and it was really a nice sort of Frank Capra moment for everybody. The reason that I love that case, and I just heard about it a week ago, and you can tell probably that I'm still pretty excited about it, is not only that it had such a fantastic outcome for the people involved, but also that it really illustrates the impact that civil legal services can have and some important facts about civil legal services. The first thing to know, I think, is that Martha was working. Oftentimes, when people think about legal aid and legal assistance, I think the image, if there is one at all that comes to mind, is one from 20 or 30 years ago when many of our clients were unemployed. Now, the majority of our clients are working. The working poor really are the new face of poverty, and that is who we serve. Secondly, there was a real positive economic impact to this case. Not only did Martha and her kids have a place to live, but their landlord was made whole for several months of back rent. He avoided the cost of litigation because we were able to settle without going to court. He avoided losing the income of having the property empty while he tried to relet it. So in just this single case, there were several thousand dollars of positive economic impact for that community. And third is that this result was really only possible because there was intervention. If the matter had gone to court, there's no question Martha would have been evicted. She was legitimately behind on her rent. So she and her children likely would have been homeless. The landlord would have lost the back rent. He wouldn't have been able to recapture it. He would have had the additional expense of going to court. So everybody would have lost in that scenario. Instead, because we were able to intervene, Martha and her children have a place to live. The medical debt issue is under control, and the landlord has been made whole and now gets to keep a good tenant. And I really think that this is why legal services are so important in the state. And I hope you will agree with me that not only is this a real concrete expression of our value as Minnesotans of providing justice, but it is also a powerful investment in our communities, in our fellow citizens, and ultimately in the lives of your constituents. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague.
Excuse me, Representative Cornish.
On that note, Madam Chair, sir, what's your name again?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lund.
My name is David Lund, L-U-N-D.
Mr. Lund.
Representative Cornish.
Can you pick and choose who you help or not? In other words, is it a strict income guideline? In other words, say it's like a person makes, or just make up a figure, say the limit of $30,000, who you can help and who you can't if they've got an income. If somebody's made a lot of bad mistakes and has a debt pile up so they have no money left, can they come to you for help and you can give them some, or is that limit the limit? Is it an adjusted income, or what? How do you determine the income from there? Do you have any way you can do compassion, or is it a hard line figure?
Mr. Lund.
Madam Chair, in general, the limit is a pretty firm limit. There are a few exceptions where we have specific grant funding, like for seniors, for example, where you have Title III funding, there's no income limit. But in general, resources are quite scarce, and so we do often turn away people that we would like to help just because we can't.
Representative Cornish.
That's good.
Representative Griskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, what are those absolute limits?
Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our basic income guideline is 125% of the federal poverty line, which varies by household size.
Excuse me, if I could just get whoever's phone keeps digging to turn off the sound. I don't care if the phone's on, just turn off the sound. I'd appreciate it. Mr. Lund.
That can vary a little bit from program to program, but I think most of the programs in the state share the same guideline.
And next is, could you please tell me how to pronounce your last name?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to. Kathy Hockadall. Yes, and I am Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. David has given you a really good example of how we change the lives of Minnesotans every single day, 49,000 of them in 2011, which is the last year for which the Supreme Court has as yet compiled all the figures. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we do that work, give you an overview of what we do, an overview of our network. I want to also talk to you a little bit about the widening justice gap in Minnesota. There are fewer and fewer people able to access our services. Talk a little bit about funding for our services, and at the end, hopefully have a minute to talk about how we might together close the justice gap just a little bit. As David's story illustrates, we make a tremendous impact on the lives of low-income Minnesotans and Minnesotans with disabilities and seniors. We keep people housed. We keep them safe. In fact, a national study indicated that one of the most important factors in reducing domestic violence in a community is to have a civil legal services office available. We also help reduce financial exploitation, which has been rampant, as I'm sure you have read in the papers and seen in your constituencies, among seniors and people in disabilities during the recession, as scammers tried their best to take people's hard-earned money away. We also help to create efficient and accountable government. We create efficiency in the court system by providing representation, and that makes the courts move more smoothly. When we are able to provide representation, they don't appear pro se. In addition, we keep unmeritorious claims out of the court because we won't take unmeritorious claims, and we tell people if they have a claim or not, and we will direct them to other resources or resolutions if we can. We also provide public and professional education for law enforcement, for the courts, for public libraries, for social workers to help them help other people in Minnesota. And we provide technological resources that are available to the entire public, particularly our Law Help Men website, which I'll talk about a little more in a minute or two. We are a core government service, part of the justice system, and we assure access to that system for people with little means. We help people solve real problems, the kinds David illustrated. We only handle matters of civil law. We don't do any criminal law. And we prioritize matters of basic human need, the need for safety, the need for shelter, the need for health care, and the need for sustenance. Our network is the largest programs, and the ones that provide the most service in the state are six regional programs that provide services in all 87 counties of the state of Minnesota. And our programs provide comprehensive services. So if a client walks in with one problem, like a client that came to us a while ago and had an unemployment compensation problem, had been unjustly denied unemployment compensation, but it turned out she actually had another problem. She was a victim of domestic violence. And we were able to get her unemployment compensation benefits, plus help her get safe, get a divorce, get custody of her children, and get child support so that her life was fully stable, not just addressing one legal need. In addition, our network includes about two dozen smaller programs that are targeted. Maybe they address one particular legal issue, or they are narrow in geographic focus. Maybe they only operate in one county. We provide an array of different services. We have full representation services where we will represent people in court or in administrative agency proceedings. We also provide a lot of people with advice and consultations. Sometimes this includes brief negotiations, such as in the case David described, where we don't need to ultimately go to court with the person. And we do a substantial amount of education and promote self-help resources. I talked a little bit before about our education for a variety of professionals, including, I think I omitted, private attorneys, who we leverage volunteer attorney resources significantly throughout the state by providing recruitment and training for volunteer private attorneys. In addition, the Law Help website, which I mentioned before, is a critical component of the court self-help system and the public library system. It has several dozen legal information fact sheets on it, written in basic language so that really anyone almost can understand them if they can read at a sixth grade level. And we also have a number of document assembly programs on that website. We provide live call-in assistance if someone is having trouble navigating the site. And we have an interactive map so that people can find their closest legal services organization. Over 260,000 unique visits occurred to that website in 2012. And anyone in Minnesota who can't afford an attorney can access that site. It is not limited to people with low incomes. We solve problems in a number of different areas, but our major areas of service are family and domestic violence, economic stability and benefits, and housing. So, for example, in the benefits area, a man came to our office a little while ago who had worked his whole life, but he was in his 50s, and he had a stroke and developed a heart condition. He had been denied SSI, Social Security Insurance, by the federal government. He could no longer work. We reviewed the case. We thought we could win, and we did. We took it to a hearing. He not only got ongoing SSI benefits for the foreseeable future, probably permanently, but he also got 3 years of retroactive benefits from the date he should have qualified for the benefits and was rejected. Another important aspect of this case is this brought in federal money to the state. It, when we are able to prevail in an SSI or a Medicare or an, another Social Security income stream, this is federal dollars that's leveraged for the state of Minnesota. In 2011, we served 49,000 people. A question was asked earlier about the income level. Some of the programs in our network go up to 200% of the federal poverty level, but most of the clients that all of the programs serve are at 125% or below. This is because we are trying to prioritize the most critical human needs for the most vulnerable Minnesotans. And 125% of poverty is $28,000 approximately for a family of four. As I said, we look at basic critical human needs, we look very seriously at the claim, the merit of the claim. We take very seriously the resources that you and others provide us to give these services. We want to use them wisely, and as a result, we take cases that have merit, and we tell people that their if their case doesn't have merit, that they don't, and tell them why. Often people are happy just to get some answer of why they can't succeed. And we refer them to another resource or resolution if we can. But what has happened in the past several years due to the recession is whereas there was always a justice gap, there has been all over the country, certainly not only in Minnesota, most studies indicate that about 20 to 30% of the civil legal needs of low-income people in the country are met. Whereas that gap used to be like this, during the recession it has gone like this. And we did a self-survey in our programs of the people we were turning away. And in 2009, we were meeting the needs of one of every two eligible clients that called us. We get lots of calls from people who aren't eligible. So this is one of every two people who called us who were eligible. Unfortunately, in 2012, we redid the survey and we were meeting the need of one of every three people who were calling us. This is the result of the recession. The number of Minnesotans eligible for civil legal services has increased by more than 20% in the past few years. At the same time, the financial resources available to us have decreased by 16%. So as I say, the gap, which was like this, has unfortunately gone to that. This means we have served fewer people. In 2009, we served almost 53,000 people. In 2011, we served 49,000. Another change we've had to make, we've felt, is to provide less full representation in an effort to try and meet the needs of as many people as possible. But the consequence of providing less full representation is more pro se litigants in the court system. And so that is something we constantly review, but it has been a core value to us to try and reach and help as many people as possible. We have a variety of funding sources, and three of them are administered by the Supreme Court through their Legal Services Advisory Committee. One is the general appropriation. The appropriation for 2013 is a little over $11 million. By statute, 85% of the appropriation goes to the regional programs I described for you, and 15% is distributed through discretionary grants that are determined by the Legal Services Advisory Committee. The two other sources of state-administered funds are interest on lawyers' trust account, which, as you can imagine, has gone way, way down with the interest rates that we have and is estimated to be $757,000 available for this year, and the attorney registration fees, which is estimated to be $1.8 million for this year. These are IOLTA and the attorney registration fees are also distributed through discretionary grants by the Supreme Court's committee. The funding trend has been down. You can see on your graph that the last 2 years it goes up a little. That would be if we got our full request of $2.1 million. Otherwise, it's really that two lines to the left that is where we lie now. all the different sources have gone down except the attorney registration fee, which did increase by $600,000 due to an increase in the fee imposed by the courts. And civil legal services, as you can see from this graph, has gone down more than with the court systems. You see the bump in the middle of the graph, which is when the court system was consolidated. But if you eliminate that bump and you kind of look at the line, as you can see, the court's funding has been more stable than civil legal services, which has had a more downward trend. We have quite a mix of funding. We will try to get funds from wherever we can. The state appropriation is obviously critical for us. It's about 35% of our funding. We also get funding grants from other governments, from federal government, from local governments, county and city. And in addition, we seek money from the United Ways, from foundations. We seek private funding from law firms, from individual donors. From most sources, the funding has gone down, I'm sure it's no surprise, in the past several years due to the recession. To address that decrease in funding, we've had significant reductions within our system. We have had furloughs, we've had salary freezes, and we've had attrition and layoffs. We have 25% fewer legal advocates. That doesn't include support staff, but it's attorneys and trained legal advocates in the system. It reduced 25% from 2007 to 2011. We also have tried very hard to increase the efficiencies we have. We have a number of programs have consolidated back-end services like administration and technology. We use technology as much as we can to reach more people and to serve people more efficiently, for example, cutting travel time by using technological means to reach our clients. But nonetheless, the justice gap is what I said. It's very large, and it has grown in the past several years. In the short term, what we would hope as a strategy to decrease the justice gap and would be to have an increase in our general fund appropriation to restore capacity lost during the recession, to mitigate the impact of the recession on people with low incomes, disabilities, and seniors in Minnesota. In addition, we will request a removal of the restrictions that were imposed in 2011 for the first time in receiving an appropriation from the state. That restriction required us to prioritize the state appropriation for matters of purely federal law. That has made it more difficult for us to provide the wide range of services that we need to provide to our clients and to use our funding to seek things like federal income and disability benefits for clients like the one I described to you earlier. And in the long term, we hope that there can be even more closing of the justice gap, not just to pre-recession levels, but perhaps to close that gap even more. We believe that will improve the lives of low-income Minnesotans. It will help assure independent living for people who are seniors and people with disabilities. It will keep victims of domestic violence safe. It will keep victims of domestic violence safe. It will keep people housed as David's client. It will also promote confidence in the justice system. When people have access to justice and they believe they will have a fair shake, they have more confidence in the system. That's an essential underpinning of our democracy, and that's a good reason, I think, to support the closing of the justice gap. Thank you so much for your attention, and we'd be happy to answer your questions.
Questions from members? Representative Portman.
I'm hoping we can get a copy of the presentation electronically. Do you get all of the income from the IOLTA accounts, or do you share that with another entity?
Madam Chair, Representative, all of the IOLTA money is distributed to the Legal Services Network through the Supreme Court's committee.
Representative Portman.
And then this is probably a Supreme Court question, but you might know the answer. So is the attorney registration fee a discretionary fee determined by the Supreme Court?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the Supreme Court sets the level of the attorney registration fee, but of course it's not discretionary to pay it, just the amount.
I'm well aware of that.
I would add about IOLTA that what the committee, the Supreme Court's committee, does because of the fluctuations in the IOLTA funds, it may not distribute out always every year the revenue that is available. It makes a decision as to how much it wants to hold in reserve. But the reserve has shrunk to very little.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, ma'am, are any of the legal advocates overlap? Like, say somebody goes to the CADA shelter of domestic abuse, they have staff down there that advise them about certain things to do with TROs and everything else. Could they get some of that there rather than come to you, get that free rather than come to you too? Or how do you network with the other people that offer legal advice free?
Ms. Huckel.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a very important question. We work very hard to connect with and not duplicate other services available in individual communities. We have offices all over the state. We have generally quite close working relationships with other social service providers or other nonprofits, such as domestic violence shelters. And if there is another service available, we want people to use that service, but we are there particularly to address legal services. And so we cross-refer sometimes with those agencies you're describing, so people can get safety planning perhaps from another agency. But if there's a legal issue that other agency, even if they have attorneys available, that they do not handle, they can refer to us.
Okay. Further questions from members? Our Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, the 125% of poverty guideline, does that include only income earned, or does it also take into account the value of people who might be signed up for one or more of our many generous welfare programs?
Ms. Huckabee.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is all income to the household, so it would include everything.
Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would include housing assistance and some of these other things that are sometimes passed through or paid to providers, et cetera. Health care benefits from the government, are those included as well?
Ms. Huckel.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do ask people about all of their sources of income and their assets, if they have any, although our clients tend to have no assets.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, members. For the next hearing, we will be going briefly over the governor's budget just so that you can understand the recommendation is this account for this much money, and then we'll be at a later hearing take each and every area and bring folks back so that they can talk about what's in the budget. And then we do have a few of the last presenters at the next hearing for other subject matters. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.